Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. It's a brilliant madcap film that was nearly lost to the proverbial dustpan of history. The Soviet film My Grandmother, directed and co-written by Kota Mikhaberidze, lampooned Soviet bureaucracy and was banned a year after it was released in 1929. Luckily for us, this silent film was rediscovered in the 1970s, and finally, in the last several years, given a music score worthy of its cinematic innovations. Today we're going to talk about this film, recently out in DVD, the music created for it, and some of the interrelationships between Soviet cinema and politics. We're pleased to be joined in studio by the woman behind the musical reinvigoration of My Grandmother. Her name is Beth Custer, and she's a celebrated musician and composer who has written scores for a number of films, both silent and talkies. We'll tell you more about her in a moment. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi, CS. Thank you.
We're also joined in studio by Steve Side, who is the video curator at the Pacific Film Archive based at UC Berkeley. Steve commissioned the rescoring of My Grandmother. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
And we're joined by phone from New York by Andrei Krenov. He is a Russian film historian who has just completed a book published in Moscow about the affinities between Soviet avant-garde films of the 1920s and American experimental films of the 60s and 70s. He's also the nephew of Leonid Trauberg, who founded the Factory of the Eccentric Actor, a Soviet artistic movement that had a strong influence on this film, My Grandmother. Welcome to you, Andrei.
Hello.
Hello. Beth Custer, let me start with you and ask you what this film, My Grandmother, is about. What goes on in this film? What should listeners know?
This is a film about a guy. A grandmother in Russian slang, as I understand it, is comeuppance or an in to get a job. You have to have a grandmother in order to get a job. And we see our guy, who's kind of a Harold Lloyd lookalike, be totally lazy and play with toys and lose his job, and then spends the entire film chasing after a grandmother, watches other guys who have a grandmother and trying to get another job. And then he thinks he gets a letter of recommendation, when in actuality it's a letter of like telling him to get the hell out of the office and don't come back. Meanwhile, in between, his wife, finds out that he lost his job. She comes home from a huge shopping spree and she literally kicks him out of the window, two or three stories up, and all that kind of comic slapstick stuff goes on as well.
And so this is not a literal grandmother. This is, in fact, not even a woman. The person he goes to for this recommendation to get his job back is an executive.
Exactly. There's a lot of executives, and there's also a lot of scenes that take place inside this sort of, I guess you could call it like an office building, where there's these, one room has chairs suspended seemingly in midair and the camera follows around and each door has door is suspended and each door has a accountant or some kind of title on it. And then there's other rooms where there's just women furiously typing constantly through a scrim. And then there's these love scenes too, where some of the executives are goofing around throwing love notes in airplanes to the secretaries, and there's all these little tiny subplots that are very funny. It's very...
Steve, do you want to add anything to what Beth has said about the plot of this film?
Well, in a sense, you can't separate the plot from the technique of the film, which is completely antic and has these kind of outsized, distorted sets and uses animation techniques and kind of slapsticky things, integrated into it. So it becomes this big pageant of a sort with, what nowadays we might even consider to be slight surrealistic touches added to it.
And what are some of the stylistic aspects? There's puppetry, which kind of is unusual, at least to me, in a film from the 1920s. What other kinds of things are in there, and where might they have come from? How might they have been inspired?
There are even things like animation that are literally applied directly on the scenes, and so objects in this domestic setting that we return to several times kind of come alive and run around and hide under the furniture and things of that sort, which was, somewhat of an unheard-of technique at the time. I mean, certainly animation was being practiced, but not integrated into live action in this way.
Andrei Krenov, so we've heard from Beth Custer that we have this bureaucrat at, I think it's called the Torque Trust, and he is let go, and he then tries for much of the rest of the film to try to get his job back. He finds a grandmother, which is another high-ranking official, an executive somewhere, who gives him a recommendation letter. And then Beth told us what that recommendation letter actually consisted of. What do you want to add to just the basic plot, the storyline of this film?
Well, actually, it's easier to understand this film reading the historical context, and maybe we can return to the storyline if you want to do that. In terms of the film, I would like to add that the animation, which was mentioned by Steve. Konstantin Mikhaberidze, Katem Mikhaberidze, used puppetry for the first time in Georgian cinema. And also the film was accused in formalism because of our difficult experimental techniques in the film, which would be perceived, by the working audiences as an obstacle and not as an aid to educational entertainment, as it was the doctrine at that time.
In other words, these experimental techniques, what didn't make as clear to the authorities as they would have liked what the political or social message of the film was?
Well, there were several reasons, and now we can only guess why the film was banned according to the protocol, which remained in their archives. But definitely not giving an aid to educational entertainment was one of the reasons.
And we will get heavily into the political and social context of this film, and Andre is a great resource for that. We'll address that. It's very interesting a little bit later this hour. Beth, you've spoken about having a certain allegiance to this film. So this isn't just a silent film that perhaps amused you. There was something about this film that you found important to, obviously important enough to contribute to in a musical way.
Well, I became completely entranced with it because of its density, but also I've always been completely anti-bureaucratic and can't stand bureaucracy. In fact, I can't understand why it takes, you know, we don't have hydrogen cars, or why we don't have more efficient everything, trains to, you know, I just learned that we're not going to have a fast train to LA now because they're going to build more roads and cars. I mean, it's just those kind of things drive me crazy, why they can't be a more efficient, why it takes, you know, big bureaucracies so long to, you know, do things. It just, to me, it's like this such an inefficient way to live. And so I just really related to that. I thought it was great to have it from a sense of humor angle. I also just really like the era of film. I mean, I've worked with Clubfoot for, you know, 20-some million years, and have been composing and performing with them since the inception in the early 80s. And so it stemmed from my work with them as continuing along those lines with my own ensemble. There's nothing like playing live in a theater to a film and having having my band members. I constructed the score so that my band members each had a character or a feeling in the film that they had to portray in their own improvisational sections, or so that we're self-conducted when we play.
Beth Custer is a San Francisco-based composer, performer, band leader, proprietress of BC Records. She is founding member of, which she just mentioned, the Clubfoot Orchestra, which is kind of a band that accompanies silent films. Maybe that's the best way to describe it. Also, she does lead the Beth Custer Ensemble and has been part of a number of other musical groups. She's an award-winning musician. And we're talking about the score that she created, that she composed to accompany this film, Soviet Georgian film, My Grandmother, which was released in 1929 and then banned in the Soviet Union a year later. Steve Side, curator at the Berkeley-based Pacific Film Archive, which presents rare and rediscovered prints of movie classics, new and historic works by the world's great film directors, restored silent films with live musical accompaniment. I imagine, Steve, you saw this film before Beth, and I wondered how it came to pass that the PFA, the Pacific Film Archive, commissioned the rescoring or the scoring of this film, The Grandmother, My Grandmother.
I certainly saw this film previous to the commission. And, we actually have a pretty decent Soviet silent film collection that was being accumulated in the later 70s and early 80s. It was, in a sense, it was in that historical period when the Soviet Union was starting to loosen up and a lot of collectors were finally getting their hands on some significant silent films from that period. But this film in particular is just such an unusual but overlooked film, so that when we had a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to do commissions, the series was called Unsilent Film. This just seemed like such an obvious one to pull out. You know, there are films like Man with a Movie Camera and, Eisenstein's Potemkin that seem to go through the cycle of getting score after score after score, mm-hmm. and no one ventures much farther than that. Mm-hmm. And we had this, lovely film.
Right. Yeah. Did the sort of anti-bureaucratic message of the film, did that appeal to you personally?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, it's such high satire. You know, the central settings that have all of the bureaucrats sitting around this big circular table and, the way in which, they manage to, with great theatrics, get absolutely nothing done is kind of amazing to see now. But, it must have been incredibly risque at the time. I don't know truly, what the sense of the bureaucracy was back then, but it really was just dragged through the mud in this film.
Mm. Can we assume, Steve, that when this silent film was released in the Soviet Union in 1929, that there was a musical score to accompany the silent film at that time?
My assumption is that if there was a score, it would have been... Well, it's actually more likely that it was improvisational piano, as most accompaniment was.
Some, just live in the theater.
Some films, actually had very formal and huge and orchestral accompaniment, but that was quite unusual, and it usually relied on the stature of the filmmaker to pull off something like that. This film in particular, because it was banned, etc., I would assume had a very small conservative accompaniment.
Now, before we ask Beth Custer about what she wanted to do while she was creating the score to this film, let's hear some music from the film My Grandmother.
Thank you.
music from the Beth Custer Ensemble on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and also on kpfa.org online. Co-producer Sasha Lilly is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. And that music accompanies a silent film made 77 years ago in the southern Soviet province of Georgia. It's called My Grandfather, and it was My Grandmother, excuse me. It was directed and co-written by Kota Mikaberidze, and we have in studio Beth Custer, we have Steve Side from the UC Berkeley-based Pacific Film Archive, and we have Andrei Krenov. He is a Russian film historian who knows a lot about this film and a lot about the political times in which it was made, and I'm looking forward to talking with him in some depth. Beth, as you were given this commission to create a score for My Grandmother, what were you thinking about, and what is the goal of someone who scores a silent film, at least in your mind?
Well, like I said earlier, it's really enjoyable for musicians in my world, musical world, to play in theaters. We do a lot of performing in clubs, and it's nice to actually be in a theater. It's great. I think it's like a collaboration with a filmmaker. I've done a couple of films with live filmmakers where we perform live. That's always fascinating to work in collaboration. But with this film, I just came to realize after researching it and learning about it at the PFA and working on it for so many years that it never, I feel, never really got its due. And so it's almost, I feel like it's my duty to give it some greater audience, what I'm hoping. So I meant to mention earlier, it also became a complete bureaucratic nightmare buying the film, buying the rights to the film from Gosfilmofon, although they were very nice. You know, you send an email over there and, you know, they respond 3 months later and you have a deadline in 2 months, you know. But anyway, it took 2 years to finally purchase the rights. But I just completed a tour of the East Coast, playing in four venues out there, and I'm going to set it up on the West Coast as well. I'm going to keep playing it because I just think it's such an enjoyable event for people to see, and kind of unusual to see an eight-piece ensemble performing to such an unusual film.
Yeah. And is there something about the music that you want to match with, for example, not just the action? There's a lot of madcap action, and there's this wonderful sort of madcap music you've created to accompany it. But also, the actors speak, and of course, as usual in a silent film, you see the white letters on a black screen indicating what they're saying. But is there some way you want to relate the music to that as well?
Well, I decided to... we used Nils Frichtl, who's a great local musician and actor, and I decided to incorporate actually having the narration become part of the score. So he acts out the narration in a kind of a similar, what I compare it to is Least Word is Sold Out by Stravinsky, where there's spoken word with music. And most people really enjoy it. There's occasionally a person who doesn't like it, the interpretation, because oftentimes that's done in a very kind of proper manner where it's just read. But Nils really went to town and kind of uses different voices. And but I really enjoy and have been studying a lot of putting text with music. It's really an interesting path for me. So I that's what I created with this.
Beth Custer on Against the Grain. Steven Side with us from the Pacific Film Archive as well. Andrei Krenov, Russian film historian, joins us as well. Now, Andrei, the film My Grandmother was made in the late 1920s in the Soviet Union, and there's probably a lot to say about this period, of course. Lenin fell ill in the early 1920s and died, I think, in 1924. And then you had this sort of power struggle between Stalin and Trotsky, who many assumed would succeed Lenin in power in the Soviet Union. Give us a sense of the political environment in the USSR at the time, around the time that this film was made.
Yeah, it's we can actually come back to historical context. But first, I would like to mention that this film, this very film, is on the very borderline. It came right out between two periods, that is, of the new economic policy from 1922 to 27, and that is an interim measure when Bolsheviks allowed some private ownership and market system, and the first five-year plan with a fully controlled economy when Stalin came to power, and that was from 28 to 32. So film appeared right in between. Of course, in a cultural field, the moderate pluralism of the early 20s was destroyed by Stalin. Even when the official call for new Soviet Gogols and Saltykov-Shchedrins, those the 19th century satirists, was made, this very justification of satire eventually led to its demise. And Mika Bereza's film was made in the second year of the five-year plan, when every trace of individual style has already started to be denounced as formalist, formal. So, but we also, I can mention that comedies of the early years of the communist regime were made at the moment when the promise of socialism has yet to be realized. And My Grandmother shows exactly these collective utopian aspirations. The film was banned, and if I can talk a little bit about history of the ban on distribution, then through doing that I can show the history of the country.
Yeah, and before we get to that, what explains the allowance, the authorities allowing such kind of wild, free-flowing experimentation in the realm of culture and theater and art in the early 1920s, as opposed to, and what explains the latter sort of, we need to get down to what's been called socialist realism, very simple narratives, a kind of disdain for experimentation. What explains those two tendencies?
Yeah, actually, the main thing is the market forces. If we were turning to the history of film production, we can see that during NEP or New Economic Policy in the 20s, the Bolsheviks used film as a powerful instrument for bringing message to people, for disseminating egalitarian ideas, and so on. But here's a paradox. Ideologically correct spectacles got very, very small audiences, and many of these films were formally challenging and experimental, like those of Eisenstein, Vertov, or Pudovkin. Political messages and commercial success just didn't get along. And moreover, Soviet film industry was required to finance its development from its own sources. For example, all avant-garde masterpieces were financed with the revenues from distribution of American films, with Chaplin, Keaton, and Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford visited Moscow, and it was a great success. And also those Russian melodramas that imitated Hollywood formulas by Protasanov and so on. So in early 30s, when Stalin came to power, the import of foreign films was limited, and domestic production dropped when Stalin became a supreme censor who personally saw and approved all films released. The era of the few films, Malokartinya, started. And that's why socialist realism was given an absolute monopoly. It was a formulaic art that excluded any irony, ambiguity, and experimentation, which was actually, it presented a fictional reality. It has nothing to do with the experimentation of the 20s.
Apart from the Soviet authorities, did the Soviet public at that time, did they like avant-garde films, avant-garde art?
No, of course not, and that's why I'm saying these spectacles got very small audiences. It was, even Eisenstein, Battleship Potemkin, was played with a certain success, but in a few cinema theaters, and the majority of the shows at that time was given to very melodramatic production of Measure of Poem and others. Spectators voted for melodramas, and they they actually received them, and they were kind of source of income for financing the Soviet film industry.
That is Andrei Krinov. He is a Russian film historian based in New York. And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. I'd like us to spend a little more time with Beth Custer's music. This, again, is music created by she, by her, and the Beth Custer Ensemble to go along with the film My Grandmother. Let's hear some more. Music created by and performed by the Beth Custer Ensemble to accompany the Soviet Georgian film My Grandmother. And by the way, this film is out in DVD, and if you want information about how to get it, you can go to Beth Custer, Beth, C-U-S-T-E-R.com. We also have a link to that website, Beth Custer's website, on our website, againstthegrain.org, where we also have links to, I think, a kind of review of the film, as well as to the Pacific Film Archives, which, if you've been listening, played a big role in bringing this film back to at least Bay Area audiences and, of course, commissioning a brand new score for the film. Beth Custer joins us in studio. Steve Side is curator at the Berkeley-based Pacific Film Archive. Andrei Krenov is a New York-based film historian. He joins us by phone from New York City. My name is C.S. Song. Andre, your uncle was the founder of an artistic movement in the 1920s, at the time this film was made, called the Factory of the Eccentric Actor. Tell us about that and what that movement's relationship to this film is.
Well, actually, this factory is very representative of the trend of the early 20s, when the collectivist authorship was very, very popular. Not just facts, but the group of Kuleshov, or the group of collective group of Dzigovertov were founded. Those people came to the provinces, to the from the provinces to the big cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg. For example, Kosintsev and Trauberg, my uncle and my grandfather, they the young Jewish artists from Odessa, from Kiev, they came to St. Petersburg to create the new art. The Factory of the Eccentric Actor was founded in Petrograd. It was first an early theatrical workshop, and their plays included film projections, by the way. And since 1924, it became a film collective. They found their inspiration in popular genres like circus, vaudeville, variety, or Nat Pinkerton detective novels. I remember that my uncle was a great collectioner, was an avid collectioner of American pulp novels. And they revered America, of course, as a home of Edison, for example, an emblem like an emblem of electricity and inventor of cinema, of strident sounds, advertisement, popular culture, and jazz. So they were infatuated with all things American, and that is important as well. And also in My Grandmother, we can see many referrals to American to American influence at that time. For example, we can see actors dancing the Charleston, or the main character is modeled after Harold Lloyd. Of course, it's kind of the rhythm of American slapstick. So that was a common infatuation.
Harold Lloyd, we should say, was a U.S. actor. He was dubbed the King of Daredevil comedy, and he was in the 1920s, one of the most popular and highest paid silent film stars of his time. And yeah, this guy, this protagonist in this film, really does resemble him in both manner and in appearance. What about the so-called left front of art, Andre? Another movement, maybe you could correct me on that. And this involved the Soviet poet and playwright Vladimir Mayakovsky.
Yes.
What was the left front of art?
Oh, yeah, it's not we can call it a movement, but it was a certain tendency or a trend which started with the periodical, with the journal which was published by Vladimir Mayakovsky. The film actually is My Grandmother is based on a screenplay of Siko Dolidze, who belonged to a Transcaucasian left, and in every Russian republic there was a left, let's say, a branch.
Left is left front of art. Okay,
yes,
go on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, left front of art. And in in the Caucasus, in Tbilisi, that was actually formed from the former Dadaist group, the group of Dada, which was called 41 Celsius, formed in Tbilisi by poets Kruchonek and Zdanevich, good friends of Mayakovsky. So here it follows a certain eccentric tradition with Dada. Also, the members of Opayaz and Lev, Viktor Shklovsky and Sergei Tretikov, they worked at the Tbilisi studio as screenwriters consultants for 2 years, from 26 to 28, and they advocated the ideas of productional, utilitarian, organizational art, which is a certain essence of Lev. And for Mikhaberidze, these ideas were influential. Some parts of My Grandmother can even be seen as a production film with its dominance of raw material, fact, and detail that Tretikov used against the melodramatic and ethnographic flowery narratives of Georgian film industry at that time. And those narratives, of course, were more popular, as I said, than the avant-garde experimental and politically correct films at that time. But, you know, so Tretikov wrote many scripts, including Solfos Vanesha, Elisor, and Habarda. That's they came out at that time when Mikhaberidze's film came out. And we can't say for sure, but of course they knew each other, and there was a certain influence.
Kota Mikhaberidze, he directed and co-produced the Soviet-Georgian film My Grandmother, which we're talking about today, which lampooned bureaucracy and was banned in the Soviet Union a year after it was released in 1929. And you mentioned, Andre, you mentioned Dada, which my rudimentary research into reveals that it was a movement of mostly European artists kind of disgusted with bourgeois society and its values and with kind of conservative traditional thought, culture, and aesthetics. And I imagine, Steve Side, that this sort of absurdist tendency, this tendency to maybe move beyond kind of rational analysis and present things that aren't necessarily linear, for example, play a big role in the kinds of films you at the Pacific Film Archive want to explore and present as part of your maybe more experimental mission?
Ooh, that's a big question. Well, you know, a lack of reason maybe is underneath a lot of the avant-garde in a sense, in the idea that it is tapping into something that doesn't necessarily have an allegiance to the rational. And even in My Grandmother, you can see in a lot of the characterizations, there are like almost like visual transformations of some of the characters, you know, where they kind of grow in stature rooms are transformed around them. So there really is like an underpinning of some unreasonable logic going on. And maybe that would have been, well, attractive to an audience because it implies a kind of instability about things.
Beth Koster, what about this sort of anarchic feeling to the film? And what do you think about the appeal of such a film with kind of all these weird things happening everywhere in the film to, say, modern American audiences? Obviously, in promoting this film and in being a part of it, you believe that there's something about its feeling, its gestalt, that still appeals maybe to people.
Well, I look at it and see that really things haven't changed, and the same thing goes on now, where there's just, I mean, it, the whole idea that, you know, I grew up in the era of the Cold War, where, you know, the Russians were going to nuke us at any moment, and, you know, they were the other people that were, you know, threatening us all the time, and now I see that, you know, they're just people just like us or whatever, and things that were going through this film, I kind of see things that were going on there were going on here as well, filmically, and also now I see that, you know, this, it's a timeless piece, and that, you know, we still have these incredibly huge bureaucracies where these guys are just goofing around and, you know, sitting at their desks playing, you know, video games or whatever, and, you know, it's part of the cause of the why progress moves so slowly, or why things move so slowly, and I just think that there's also something for everybody in the film, whether it be kids or adults, because it's because it does have that slapstick appeal, and then there's all these political slogans at the end that are really interesting to see too, that, you know, at the very end. And I'd like to find out from Andre about the figure that comes in at the end, if he is indeed supposed to be Stalin.
The final figure who hands over the letter of recommendation. Oh, no, who is presented with the letter of recommendation.
Right. No, that one.
Right.
At the very end. Because I've always thought, well, maybe this is a really, I didn't really know why, because there's, like Steve and I were talking earlier, it's hard to find out much about the film here. There's not much written. And so it'd be interesting to find out what the reason for the banning, you know, was more.
Yeah, so Andre, I mean, you've done some pretty in-depth research into why this film was banned in 1930. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Okay, yeah, it's a very good question, because for American film critics, the figure of the worker who actually appears in the end when there was a reshuffling of the directors, and Mihalko is trying to handle the letter of recommendation, and in the end the worker appears. This figure of the worker resembled, for American critics, Vladimir Lenin. No one than nice. Vladimir Lenin, but it's. I'm sure that Mika Beridze didn't intend to do that. Let me tell about the situation with the censorship at that time, and then it would be clear about this film. Every film studio of one of the republics at that time, and up to the even to the beginning of Perestroika, would send a screening a copy of the finished film, for a special screening in Moscow for the Central Repertory Committee. And it would include not just the party officials, but the representatives of the main local plants, factories, collective farms, but mainly those who agreed unanimously with any official decisions. Of course. Mm-hmm. In 1930, my grandmother wasn't just banned for distribution. Moreover, a report was sent to both political police, OGPU, and later KGB. The organization, this is an notorious organization, and to a People's Commissariat of Workers' and Peasants' Inspection, asking to press charges against Georgian Film Studio for this anti-Soviet picture, because it quote, showed bureaucracy in such a way that spectators' consciousness lays the groundwork against the Soviet power in general, which is a Trotskyist attitude to a corruption of the Soviet system, unquote. And indeed, At that time, Trotsky accused the party leadership of bureaucracy and inefficiency. And purges and show trials has already started. For example, everyone who voted against Stalin in any time before that was somehow repressed. There were three categories of repression. And so Stalin's industrialization and collectivization created very harsh living conditions and food shortages for both urban centers and the countryside. So Stalin had to find the scapegoats to distract somehow the workers' anger and win their trust. That's why many top executives of the food industry, agriculture, were shot after trials. And my, there is a hypothesis that one of the reasons of the ban of the film, that the censors might feel the absurdity of these purges after seeing Mikhailovich's film, like the Komsomol units, the omnipresent Komsomol units, who are forcing Mihalko to resign. It's the same units when Stalin started his purges. He turned to the masses for support, and they were everywhere, like an atmosphere of total fear.
Do we know what the intention of the filmmaker Mika Berizzi was with My Grandmother? I mean, did he intend this film to be not just an anti-bureaucratic film, but anti-Soviet power at that time kind of film?
Of course not. Of course not, because at that time the heavy hand of the party no one. Could feel that already. Of course, it was a completely fictional time when the first years of industrialization gave the certain rise of the people's spirit. But looking at the industrialization, the biggest plants couldn't be built without that spirit. But at the same time, the living conditions were very hard. Horrible. They're so harsh that in some cities there were workers' revolts. They were, of course, there were we can call it certain disturbances. So it was kind of a very peculiar reality. It was kind of double notorious Soviet double think.
Do we know whether the maker of this film? Even if he wasn't sort of anti-bureaucracy in the sense of anti-Soviet authority, whether he sided, say, with Trotsky, who, of course, was the adversary of Stalin, and then the Stalinist authorities saw this film. And I mean, can we divine the intention of the filmmaker on that aspect?
I don't think so, because Mika Berizzi, all his artistic career... he was a famous actor of the silent film, and of course he was influenced by Mayakovsky ideas. But and Mayakovsky was born in Georgia. He went to Moscow when he was 13 or 14, I guess. We don't have any proofs that it was Mika Berizzi's intention. It was one of the best efforts, one of the most honest efforts to accuse bureaucracy, to pave the way for the new collectivist and egalitarian society, the building of the socialist society.
We're talking about the Soviet Georgian film My Grandmother, and that is Andrei Krinov. He is a Russian film historian who has just completed a book published in Russia about the affinities between Soviet avant-garde films of the 1920s, of which this film is one, and American experimental films of the 1960s and 70s. If you want to take a look at this film, My Grandmother, we have a way for you to get it. It is newly out, recently out in DVD. Beth Custer, who created and whose ensemble performs the new score to this film, a silent film, My Grandmother, has a website, bethcuster.com. You can also reach it via againstthegrain.org, and you can find out about the film, the DVD, and I think ordering information as well. And Beth, here's this film from Georgia, a Southern Soviet Republic made in the 1920s, a very different culture and time. You're commissioned to write a new score to match this. What goes through your mind, and how do you maybe if bridging the gap was one of your intentions, how do you bridge the gap between the two cultures and the two times?
It was interesting to go and study the PFA, what little there is in books there in English about this film in that era, because I wrote the score and then studied about it because of the time frame. And I just didn't have enough time to research ahead of time. But I naturally wrote a kind of very jazz-oriented, with a little bit of smattering of blues and kind of contemporary sounds. And then one movement I kind of pretended I was writing Georgian classical music. And then I went and read about this Fex movement and the eccentric actor, and they were really into Americanization and jazz. And so I thought, wow, I guess I've somehow written maybe a decent score that might, maybe even the director, I wish I could know if the director would like the score. I'm right now trying to, I've always wanted to go to Russia, and so I'm look at these projects that I do, which are kind of a lot of different ones, but I love to travel, and I would love to take this to Russia with members of my ensemble, and I've just applied for some funding to get a core group of my group and to collaborate with some Soviet musicians and perform it live in Moscow and St. Petersburg, and I hope in Georgia and in Tbilisi.
So that's fantastic. You founded and or performed with the Club Foot Orchestra, Transmission, Clarinet Thing, the trip-hop duo 80 Mile Beach. My Grandmother is not the first silent film that you have scored. Tell us about your work with the Club Foot Orchestra.
I met Richard Marriott, who actually is the founder of the Club Foot Orchestra. I just want to
make sure
about that. And but I met him at the Club Foot at a birthday party for Snakefinger, who the late great guitarist, who I also ended up living at his loft space in the alley off Mission Street with 9 other people, musicians and stuff. But we hit it off, and Richard said, would you like to join? I'm calling this group the Club Foot Orchestra, and we're going to perform at Club Foot, which was a club on 3rd Street. It's now an awning shop, but it was a kind of a burgeoning bed of activity in the punk era in the early 80s. And we performed what was to be one show, and I've still been working with him for, since 1983, so however many that years that is. But we just played 3 of Richard's scores in New York City at the World Financial Center and began writing to silent films in the late 80s. We were the first band in the United States to start doing that, that's where I began composing, was actually because Richard would take on these huge projects, and then we would kind of help him finish them. And then I did a short film myself of Peter McCandless's called The Pool of Thanatos, and began writing more and more for Club Foot, and then just started branching off and writing for films on my own.
You've also written soundtracks for contemporary films that are not silent, such as The Unoccupied Zone, The Impossible Life of Simone Weil. How does that compare to writing music for silent films?
Silent films are tricky because you don't want to, because there is no dialogue, there isn't any other sound in the film. Of course, it's a silent film, but you can't. I think you have to kind of write a fuller score, and with films that with text, you have to be more, you have to careful to underlie the action with the text and the other sounds that are coming in. So it's more a kind of a pastiche of everything, all the sounds. Silent film, I feel you can really kind of go to town and make a fuller score.
And is there something, I know there is, something you enjoy about being in a theater, performing live while the silent film is playing?
Well, there's something about, it's kind of not just, it becomes kind of a performance art piece or something, because people tell me, I don't know because I've never sat in the audience, but they watch the musicians sometimes and then they watch the film sometimes, or they sit back and try to watch the whole thing. So you're seeing this group. It's kind of, you see a larger picture. Well, I try to make it so that we are, not that visible. We have very low lighting and we face the stage, so we're not kind of, front and center. I try to make the film to be the actual.
Mm-hmm. Steve Seid, I'm sure you've seen your share of silent films with live accompaniment. What's your impression of that? What do you like, or what do you like about watching that?
What I think is actually interesting is often it's almost impossible to truly understand the motives of the director, you know, the intentions of the director. So there is a point in which, you know, the composer can take some of the film into their own hands and kind of run with it and create almost like a counter meaning.
Interesting.
And I kind of enjoy that almost more than someone who's trying to be absolutely true to the film, because then, you know, it seems like a greater compromise. So rather than that, you kind of break free of the film and create this kind of envelope, you know, a musical envelope that brings out new themes and kind of counter narratives.
So it's a collaboration of sorts, for sure, between the composer and the director.
And or the artifacts of the director,
indeed,
yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. We just have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask, Andre, if you have any kind of final words about this film and what it means to you, given your history and your relations and your familiarity with film history.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm the right person to make the conclusion, but the political history of Soviet cinema, it's a very sad history. It's a story of unrealized hopes and disappointments and constant reorganizations and attempts to do something a little differently, to express the unconventional ideas without breaking orthodoxy. And My Grandmother is the lyrical masterpiece who actually gives the death of, who actually provides, shows the absurdity, the death analysis of the absurdity of the situation of the 20s, as well as it remains, of course, an example for the accusation of the old bureaucracy in all times. This is the film which proves this sad political history of Soviet cinema, I hope that this wonderful soundtrack, this imaginative soundtrack, sound score written by Beth, will find its very good reception in the country where the film by Makaberidze was made.
We have to leave it right there. Andrei Krenov, Russian film historian based in New York. Steve Side with the Pacific Film Archive. Beth Custer, award-winning composer, musician, clarinetist, bandleader, etc. Again, information about this film on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as to Beth Custer's website, where you can find information about getting the DVD version of My Grandmother. Thanks to all of you for joining me today.
Thank you, C.S. What an honor.
And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Sasha and I will look for you next time.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit our companion website, againstthegrain.org, which has instructions for ordering CD copies of programs, links to related resources, and MP3 audio from recent shows, as well as ways of reaching C.S. and Sasha. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767. Extension 209. Our theme music is by Damal Sound System. Check them out at damalsf.com.
darkness.